Letting the last people take their seats. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Construction Costs Through the Roof, What New York Can Do. I'm Hope Cohen. I'm the Deputy Director of the Center for Rethinking Development at the Manhattan Institute, where we work to bring about a new understanding of the importance of development to New York's well-being. We particularly focus on zoning and planning and housing issues and the infrastructure that makes development successful. In research reports and opinion pieces and forums like this one, we put forward concrete and feasible proposals for reform. We're here today sponsoring this program and issuing Raise the Roof, Lower the Costs, because we're very concerned about the relationship in the subtitle: construction costs and housing affordability in New York City. To continue to thrive, the city needs people of all types living and working here. It needs the variety of neighborhoods and economies. And it's getting harder and harder for middle class and working class New Yorkers to find housing they could afford here. Of course, the Manhattan Institute is not alone in this concern by any means. It's a major topic of public discourse and the basis of Mayor Bloomberg's ambitious housing program. But our particular contribution is to focus on making construction less expensive, ideally all construction, with the greatest proportional impact on housing built for those who can least afford to have their money wasted. That's why we started down the path to this report 2 years ago, when some wondered if there was really any problem at all to discuss in the midst of a historic building boom. And now, in 2008, it's perhaps even more important, which is why we're glad so many of you could be here with us this morning. So today, we're going to start with the study's author, Rosemary Scanlon, presenting the report's key findings and recommendations. Then our distinguished panelists. Then our distinguished panelists will each have a few minutes to respond to the report and its themes. Mark Ginsburg will bring the perspective of an architect navigating the system. Community Preservation Corporation President and CEO Mike Lappin will comment from the viewpoint of a developer and the leading financier of affordable housing. And finally, construction attorney Barry LePatner will provide the national context on industry capacity. And I'm sure that we will have a very animated Q&A session. We'll get to it as quickly as possible. So let me now introduce our primary speaker and the author of our study, Rosemary Scanlon. She is an associate professor of economics at the Schack Institute of Real Estate at New York University and also a consultant in urban and regional economics. She has been a visiting research fellow at the London School of Economics. Before that, she was deputy state controller overseeing the budget of New York City. She has consulted and lectured all over the world. She's perhaps best known to us here in this room as the chief economist of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey from 1983 to 1993. When she initiated scads of research and issued many important reports on economics and demography in the region. So, Rosemary Scanlon.
Thank you, Hope. I'm so pleased to find you all here on this important topic this morning. And what I'm going to do is just go through a few key slides to highlight some of the key findings of the report. And many of these slides are already in your report, so you can see them. And just to tell you a bit about doing this report, Hope and I and her colleagues at the Manhattan Institute spent quite a few months, and in fact Hope started it 2 years before I got actively involved. And we've interviewed over 50 experts in the field in New York, architects, contractors, developers, real estate lawyers, and everybody. So what we are doing, and I think what I am doing in this report is reflecting what I have heard from the industry and drawing my conclusions on what I think are the major issues. So let me just begin. Now, this is the background. As you know, we've been living in a very strong economy in New York City. This is a chart on employment that starts back in 1997 through to last year. It shows the peak in 2000, you know, our 3 years of difficulty with the recession and the post-traumatic occurrences after 9/11, and then rising to surpass the 2000 peak in 2007. And we still are showing job gains through the early months of 2008. This chart, which was prepared by the New York Building Congress, also tells us what's been going on in the construction industry. This chart is in billions of dollars, and as you can see from that point, lower point in 2003 through to the Building Congress forecast for 2009, the dollar value of construction in the city has doubled. This year, expected to hit $28 billion in construction. So this is a boom of major proportions, maybe historic. I don't know if we ever had such good numbers going back in the past. Probably historic. Reflected in construction employment. Again, this starts in 2000. You can see the drop-off through to 2004, but then the rapid increase through 2007. And I was checking the numbers the other day, and in construction employment for buildings and in specialty trade contractors, the numbers are at the highest they've been in the last 20 years, that the numbers go back for this level of detail. So very good. So what is our finding on what's driving construction costs in New York City? As one contractor told us, everything. But in summary, it's land, it's materials prices, labor costs, particularly since 2007. It's the shortage of skilled contractors and subcontractors, with everybody stretched in this boom. And also, in our judgment, it's the cost of the regulatory process, which serves as a barrier, not only adding cost, but serves as a barrier to bringing in new firms from outside the city that might increase capacity and lower costs. A little bit on materials prices. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics Producer Price Index. You can see that mostly the price increase on materials started in 2003 through a variety of materials. Up on the left, that's metals and metal products. You can see what happened in 2004. Upper right here, that's materials and components. Again, a big increase starting in 2004. And then by 2005, these costs were being transferred through to construction machinery. You can see that increase of over 12% in 2005. And then lumber prices, which tend to reflect more what's going on in the rest of the country, over a 20% increase in 2004, but where the housing market has declined in the rest of the country, lumber prices are down. It doesn't affect us so much in New York City, but it reflects what's going on in the rest of the country. This is Turner Construction's Building Cost Index. This is for the U.S. as a whole, and you can see 2003 was still pretty mild, but by 2004, Their index costs were going up 5.4%, then 9.5% in 2005, and with a 10.6% increase in 2007. This is Engineering News Record's Building Cost Index for New York City, which is in blue on this chart, and against their 20-city index starting again in 2000. We can see the city's increase going up sharply in 2001, and much of that must have been the cleanup at the Trade Center. And then the city's costs rising. They're rising everywhere, as we can probably imagine. But look at New York City's cost increases, too, by 2006 and 2007. We're moving ahead of the rest of the cities. But as I said, we're not the only one. This is looking at the increase in building costs. Again, this is ENR's. From 2007, Chicago and Boston have also had rapid increases. But one of the points that we notice is that New York starts at such a high base. These data we're happy to get from one of the major national construction firms, which looks at the cost of office construction compared across New York, Chicago, and Atlanta. And the total project costs as of the spring of 2008 would come in at about $400 a square foot in New York. Chicago's less than half of that, $189, and Atlanta still less at $154. And while I didn't put this on a chart, the same is true for construction and housing. A major national construction firm told us that a luxury condo they're doing in Midtown Manhattan will come in at $425, $430 a square foot, but in Chicago it's $275 or so. So our costs are just higher to begin with. Just before we get to that, I've left a blank here to just give you a sense of what we think in terms of which prices can be controlled. Materials costs are more difficult. Those are set now in the global market. And it may be that there are a couple of things you can do to hedge prices in the forward markets if that's still possible, or to do a little bit of substitution of materials. But that is a national and international problem at the moment. Land prices, is affecting the construction on affordable housing. We've been told it has become a critical problem. The city has basically used up its supply of free land, as they called it, from their old MREM properties project. So land becomes a real issue, and costs have gone up dramatically. We've heard a number of issues, but for example, costs in Brooklyn, which might have run $100 or even less, $70 a square foot back in 2004, 2005, would now be up higher, much higher than that. What can we do about it? We can basically try and make more land. As one expert told us, well, we're in New York, we can build up, so we can do that. So zoning, and the Bloomberg administration has done a terrific job of changing zoning and zoning vast swaths manufacturing land, which can be done again. So we think that there's still much opportunity to rezone. One good suggestion we heard was do high-rise apartment buildings over subway stations outside of the Manhattan CBD, for example. Another issue we discovered was the parking requirement, which goes back, I think, to the 1950s or early 1960s, which still legislates or requires parking either on-site or inside in a garage in public or in market-rate housing in the boroughs. This, it seems to me, in an era of $140, I think it's $130 when we wrote it in the report, now $140 a barrel oil, seems to be an absolutely absurd requirement and should be rethought. That would free up more land on the land site and also lower the costs. And then we've also been aware of parcels that are available in nonprofit facilities throughout, particularly in Brooklyn and Queens, so that there's a possibility of changing the zoning or allowing development there. The next major issue that we thought, and we've discovered that where costs could be controlled, is in the regulatory process, and largely at the city level, where it would be possible to get greater efficiencies in the whole permitting regulatory process, not to change it, but to streamline it, to make greater efficiencies, cut down the delays, which would therefore lower costs. For example, do permits in parallel as opposed to the instances where they're done sequentially. More coordination between the agencies, we heard particularly between the Department of Buildings and the Department of Transportation. To stop imposing various forms of review on publicly subsidized housing where market rate housing doesn't have to go through similar reviews. Another example of this that we heard was to lengthen the time length it takes to get a temporary certificate of occupancy. In New York City, it takes, at least 6 months and maybe more. A national firm told us in Chicago they can get their certificate of occupancy in 1 month. They have all the same permits, but it's streamlined, so everybody does it within a month. So it would be a great cost savings. Another area, this is outside of the city's purview, but certainly something that could be done at the state level, would be to reform the state scaffold laws. Everybody calls for this. Nothing ever happens. That doesn't mean to say we don't call for it again. This way, we could lower insurance costs by increasing the number of firms that would write general liability in the city, and I think would make a big difference. And then finally, as we are heading into the last half of 2008 and early 2009, it'll be important to monitor the impact of the changes that have taken place in the important 421A program, which basically goes into full effect, or did the 1st of July, and to see what impact that's having, not just on affordable housing, but on market rate housing in the city. Thank you. I'm going to turn the program over to Hope again and my colleagues. And one more thing just before I finish. Thank you, Hope. Just wondering, where do we go next? Is there anything in the economy that will possibly ease construction costs? We know there have been some delays announced by some of the big public agencies, the MTA and the Port Authority, in the pace at which they thought they might proceed. But and then one thing we did notice is that building permits have dropped off sharply this spring. Now, whether this is a blip or the beginning of a trend remains to be seen. This perhaps would ease the pressure, although it wouldn't ease the housing problem in New York City, because what we need is more housing. Thank you, Hope.
Thanks, Rosemary. We are now going to hear from each of our three panelists. First, Mark Ginsburg. Mark's an architect who's widely known in New York City, particularly in the affordable housing community. He is a founding partner of Curtis and Ginsburg Associates, and there he's in charge of all multifamily housing and urban design projects. He has been designing housing, particularly affordable housing, for more than 25 years. He has been involved in all kinds of innovative experiments. He worked on the award-winning Morrisania Air Rights Master Plan. He has worked extensively with green technology and introducing it, particularly in affordable housing. He has worked on new techniques and designs for kind of more standard housing that's streamed down so that some of the more expensive components like elevators are not necessary. He serves on many boards. He has been president of New York's AI, American Institute of Architects chapter. He's on the board of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council. He has won many awards. And he has a lot to say about housing and the system and dealing with the city and contractors. And Mark, I'm going to unleash you now.
Thank you, Hope. And I first want to thank Rosemary, because I think her paper and her research, her report, can focus us on things that we may be able to change. And one of the things is there isn't one big thing. It's a lot of little incremental things, which is much harder. A former employer of mine and colleague and friend, Richard Dattner, said that people should get an award for finishing a building. It doesn't have to be the most beautiful building, but if it stands up, doesn't leak too much, has all its permits, and is done, it's somewhat of a miracle. And I think starting with that attitude, we need to be able to change that, but it's not going to be easy. And I think one of the other keys of where we are now is we have too much of a good thing, not that we don't need it. And that housing production was high in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, and then dropped precipitously, and has really never recovered to the last few years. So that although we have a record number of housing starts, or have had in the last few years, if you look back to the 60s, it's less. So that historically we may be catching up, it's trying to catch up. And I think we're in a situation where it's one step forward, two steps back, and let me try and give a few examples of that. And I'm going to first talk about the Department of Buildings. And 7 years ago, when the current administration came in, the building department had, as I understand this, approximately 700 lines for positions, but only 500 employees. If we'd known that they were going to have approximately 1,100 employees now, everyone would have said, gee, that would solve all the problems. And it hasn't. Not to say that if we were back where we were 7 years ago, we wouldn't have much bigger problems. And I think we're in a situation where at least recently things have gotten worse. And there are at least three reasons, two of which are short term, and it's somewhat of a perfect storm. First of all, the 421A program, which others are going to talk about, had a July 1st deadline. You had to have approved a permit and partial foundation in the ground. So there was this mad rush of everyone in the building department, and as just an example, we were closing on some HPD projects. HPD always requires a permit to close. Well, of the two buildings we were closing, 14 weeks after we filed, we got the second building's objections a day before we were closing, and I spent the time writing a response so that we could at least show the bank that we would comply with any of the objections and so they could close. It wasn't ideal, but I think this has been happening throughout. The next issue, and I think long-term this is really good, is we have adopted a new building code as of July 1st. However, that has caused short-term issues. My office is across the street from the building department, and a week ago or a week and a half ago, there was an hour and a half line to get into the department because it was the last day you could use the old forms. So everyone filled out the old forms and then had to file them or have to refill out all the forms. And so those two things have really gummed up the works. The third issue, which is a combination and has been very much in the press and I think is more long-term, is issues of safety, issues of quality of building department reviews have become major issues this spring, leading to the building commissioner, who I think was the best building commissioner in my lifetime, having to resign, is that the situation is set up where the simplest thing to do is not to do anything. Because if you approve something, you could be in trouble. But if you don't approve something, and this is less on the higher levels, but down on the examiner level, you know, there's more scrutiny, there are more questions, there are more just throw the book of issues at you so that the architect and developer and the contractor can resolve them, but it's definitely slowed things down. I wanted to give two quick examples because I want to try and be constructive of how sometimes the best laid plans don't always work out fully the way they are intended. The building department went to a system where appointments with examiners are done through 311. This was done because previously you could make appointments with the examiners, and there were sometimes the appearance and sometimes the reality of corruption. And by doing it through 311 and saying you can't make the next appointment till you've had the last appointment, it became much clearer, much more systematized. An expediter who was buddies with somebody couldn't get a favor. The downside of that was that typically if it takes 3 weeks to have an appointment with an examiner and you can only get a 20-minute appointment, which seems to be, is getting back to the examiner to review the objections to get things done is taking much longer. I don't know what the solution is, but it just you often have to spend time with the examiner going through the issues. Another example, which maybe relates to green design and maybe the theater of the absurd, is we're doing a building. It's a wonderful project. It's going to be LEED Gold plan, which is a high level of green design. And one of the things we want to do for both green reasons and aesthetic reasons is put sun shading devices on the south face of the building. But the building's right at the property line, and the shading devices are going to extend more than 10 inches over the property line. Hence, you need a revocable consent from DOT. Everyone said it didn't make sense, but those were the rules. So we went, we filled out the paperwork, submitted to DOT 3 months ago. They were very helpful. Before it has to go to the Art Commission, which is going to be our next hurdle, but before that, it has to go to all the public agencies to review it. And yesterday, and they were waiting for building department's review because building departments has been very busy. And yesterday, we got a comment from the buildings department that these devices stick more than 10 inches over the property line and they're not permitted by the building code, which is the catch-22. That's why we're doing the revocable consent. And there's this, we'll work it out. But this level of lack of communication and coordination issues that I wanted to mention. I want to talk about zoning for a minute before my time is up, and sort of two issues. One is, and I don't see any easy solution for this, our zoning regulations are overly complicated. People at city planning who spend their life understanding zoning say no one fully understands the resolution. However, when one tries to clean it up, it is very difficult. And there is very little political incentive to do that. I was just involved in something which were very minor changes that became a political football and died. And I can go into detail on that. But it just makes it hard for me as a design professional who understands the resolution very well. We miss things sometimes. It makes it hard for the building department examiners. They have a lot of new examiners. They don't fully understand the zoning. When you go to city planning's borough offices, you get comments from staff at city planning that when you talk to the senior people on zoning basically say, you know, they don't fully understand the zoning, and it makes this process hard. I mean, it probably is good for my business because people come to me because we understand the zoning relatively well, but it's a tremendous amount of energy. Now, one other thing I want to talk about briefly, which Rosemary talked about a bit, in 1961, when we last passed had a new zoning resolution, the previous resolution had allowed a build-out for 40 million residents. The 61 zoning resolution allowed a build-out for 12 million residents. Because of the rezoning, and this is a very hard thing, the city now says the zoning resolution allows for a build-out of 10 million residents. When we're approaching 8.5 million residents, and you're never going to build everything to the maximum FAR. There are a lot of buildings you can't tear down because they're landmarks, because they're valuable buildings. It explains why the land prices are getting so high. There's not much land, and there's not much few places to build. And so I think looking at rezoning, upzoning, and looking at these issues is extremely important. And although the city in the last few years has done a lot of upzonings, they've downzoned half the city. And so we're in this position now. And communities typically don't want change for all sorts of reasons, but some that are addressable. If you're going to allow bigger buildings, that means there are going to be more people using the same number of parks, the same number of schools, the same transportation system. And so one of the community's fears, which is justified, is if you want us to take more people, you need to figure out how it isn't going to lower our quality of life in very clear ways. And I think as we move forward in rezonings, a few things, we should be looking at the issues of how you, in effect, give carrots to a community so they're willing to swallow the upzoning, that inclusionary housing, which has a lot of economic issues, is a way to create land for affordable housing. I think Mike will talk more about that. And also, as we do downzonings, and there are areas that the zoning is not fitting with the context, there are often opportunities to do upzoning, and I'll give a quick example. Typically, avenues, the buildings are taller than the side streets, and zoning to a little degree, some degree, reflects this. I think it could reflect it more. And as you're looking on a side street of brownstones in Manhattan or Brooklyn or the other boroughs, which needs to be low, and so you want to keep the height down, on the avenues which have wider streets, better light and air, you could allow a taller building and in some way be balancing some of the downzonings with corresponding upzonings. And with that, I will finish my comments.
Thank you, Mark. Next, we're going to hear from Michael Lappin, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Community Preservation Corporation, which is a consortium of many banks, thrifts, and insurance companies that winds up being the leading financier of affordable housing in New York State. He's also the president and CEO of its for-profit subsidiary, CPC Resources, which led the restoration of the Parkchester development in the Bronx. Mike serves as a director of many housing organizations, and including the Citizens Housing and Planning Council also, so I guess these guys know each other from there, and is a former president and founding member of the National Association of Affordable Housing Lenders and of the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York Affordable Housing Advisory Group. He's also served on the advisory council for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He's taught, he's got many awards also, and I'm going to unleash him now.
Okay. Thank you, Hope. First of all, let me begin by underscoring the central premise in Rosemary's paper, the importance to the city's economy of building building and maintaining affordable housing to support the diversity of talent and workers that make this city so great. I agree with Rosemary, the description of why the costs have increased, and I want to just expand on some of her recommendations in the context of affordable housing. First, let me talk about streamlining. I think there are many aspects that, as Rosemary points out, within the city's power to streamline. I'm not sure she goes far enough in explaining either the possibilities or the benefits of such streamlining. Let me take you back as one example that my company was involved in the early 1970s, when the city's multifamily stock was being abandoned at an alarming rate. We were created by the major banks then to work with the city to coordinate private financing with public programs to prevent abandonment in these apartment buildings. What occurred then was that some key subsidy programs were integrated with the underwriting standards and the processing of our construction and permanent financing programs. We in effect became the processing arm for the city's efforts to prevent abandonment and rebuild some of these deteriorating neighborhoods. Such delegation was particularly important as the target market for such programs, the owners of privately owned apartment buildings in low-income neighborhoods, had neither the sophistication to deal with a myriad of public programs nor the access or credit standing to deal with most private lenders. Additionally, to make this program work effectively, we found we had to provide, in addition to coordinating these public programs with private financing, we also had to provide an enormous amount of technical expertise to these builders in terms of what to be built, what are construction specifications, what are appropriate costs, who are good contractors, who are bad contractors. We, in effect, became the back office and expert consultants in this dizzying array of programs, which was focused on rebuilding the city's decaying neighborhoods. So in a time of real crisis, the city was able to take some very bold moves to try to reverse this. The results of this coordination, of this streamlining, I think were formidable. We created high volumes of renovated buildings at low costs. Tens of thousands of buildings were renovated in the three most highly affected boroughs, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Upper Manhattan. We built these were rebuilt at up to half the cost of comparable private efforts. And this was largely the result not only of the savings, that the coordination of the processing savings of the coordination, but also we were able to lower the entry point of new developers. We created, in effect, a new generation of developers as managing agents formed alliances with subcontractors. Other subcontracts formed similar alliances. These resulting development companies became the engines for redevelopment in these neighborhoods. And many of our contractors today, who are major contractors both in new construction and renovation, grew up in these programs. And I'm sure if we look back at the history of many of the large and prominent family builders today, you'll find that they had a similar start. One of the great things in this city is this constant inflow of talent that makes this is not a closed-end system. So one of the points I don't completely agree with, Rosemary, is that there isn't a limited, it's not a zero-sum game in terms of the number of developers, the number of contractors that are available. If we can lower the bar to entry, and lowering the bar by creating this kind of streamlining, at least in this instance, does bring in a whole new generation of potential developers and builders. We saw this really confirmed. I saw Paul Crotty here this morning. The value of this was confirmed during the Koch-Tenkin's 10-year housing programs. There, what the city did was to try to they came up with three different approaches to rebuild these buildings, these vacant buildings that were formerly abandoned. One, they decided to use large construction managers to rebuild them, assemble whole blocks of buildings. Two, they worked with prominent nonprofits working now with the newly developed tax credit. Three, they did a lot of buildings on their own. And four, they worked with private owners, these same owners, who actually many of whom were developed during this earlier period, to build this building and leverage those programs of private financing. The results of this really confirm the early results. The privately built buildings were built at less than half the cost of where the big construction management efforts occurred. It proved to be much more cost efficient, and in fact, it was a much more efficient use of subsidy as it leveraged the very scarce public resources. And I'd say for the vacant lands, the New York City Partnership performed a similar function. What I'd suggest for today is that I think these approaches are very pertinent to how we might lower some costs, say, in terms of streamlining processes, particularly if we look at the ability to create new public lands through rezoning and things like this. I think these are models that have not received sufficient attention in the policy analysis, and we should look at these examples as ways. There's, you know, streamlining sounds good, but there's a lot of intricate and intelligent ways in how to do this. And depending on what kind of programs, what kind of permitting issues, they're complicated, but there are very doable models out there. So I would encourage this to more research and a very strong look in this area as a real, as a very viable and tested strategy for reducing costs. Let me go to this, Rosemary's second point, zoning, and creating more public space for residential development. I want to just take a few observations. We looked very closely at the potential purchase of Peter Cooper Stuyvesant Town when it came up on the block. As the redeveloper of Parkchester, we thought that this would be an interesting play. What struck me, I was aghast at the price that was paid, $5.6 billion. But the immediate thing that struck me was, if that's worth $5.6 billion, now this was a year ago, over a year ago now, what would be the value of adjacent publicly owned properties? What might be the value if you were to upzone, and let's just take two, there's two public housing projects directly south of that, Jacob Riis and Bernard Baruch Housing. What might be the value of the potential upzoning of those sites? And I don't know the answer, but I'm just throwing that out as a suggestion. My guess is there's substantial additional value there that could be used not to replace low-income housing in those areas, but perhaps build additional retail, build additional residential, and in fact use those proceeds, or you could use them for a number of things, but use them to build additional infrastructure, deal with the housing authorities' problems that they have, build more subsidized affordable housing elsewhere, or other things like this. I think that that particular instance could be, use that example to look at many places throughout the city. One of the things, in fact, going back to Peter Cooper, that we were looking at was, is there a way of maybe preserving 3,000 of the 11,000 plus units at Peter Cooper's Stuyvesant Town? And so one of the things is, well, what if we proposed that the city upzone maybe five blocks of First Avenue between, create 1 million feet of extra FAR on First Avenue across the street, it's pretty low rise over there, and that if anyone comes in with a plan to preserve housing at Peter Cooper, maybe put them in Mitchell Lama type regulations, that they get the benefit of getting a million feet extra across the street. It didn't happen, but it's something to think about. I think the city has a long history of using zoning to create such incentives. Certainly the most recent one was in the paper this morning, a little article about it, was when they sought to finance the High Line, they created additional zoning rights along the West Side Highway for I don't know how many blocks. And the idea, at least the concept, is to sell those air rights to fund the High Line. Creating this kind of land opportunities, additional building, combining it with streamlining, I think is a rich, rich area to think about for creating affordable housing and expanding housing opportunities. And I think also, as Mark pointed out, I'd heavily commend the mayor's existing efforts. He's done, I think, an incredible job in the rezoning efforts that have been done, particularly with the inclusionary zoning. And we can talk more about that in the Q&A. The third point in Rosemary's recommendations was preserve the use of non-union labor in construction of affordable housing. This is becoming a heated issue in the city council and the state legislature. Most recently in the state legislature, there were two bills introduced to require, and various iterations of it, anything that gets public subsidy to use prevailing wages. I think that would be very harmful to the affordable housing, to build affordable housing. We estimate it would add somewhere between 25% and 40% onto the hard cost of jobs. When we do affordable housing, you know, depending on the size, you know, we did Parkchester, it was 12,000 units. We used union labor. Most of what we do is smaller jobs. They use non-union labor. Whether you use union labor or non-union labor is pretty much predicated on the marketplace. Called big jobs, high rise, you're not going to get away without using union labor. Smaller jobs, that's where you have a long tradition of licensed contractors all over the city who do those jobs. If we were to have to use union labor or prevailing wages in a typical low rise 48 unit building that we do, it would do two things. It would add to the construction cost of roughly, or the subsidy, the required subsidy, about $20,000 a unit, or alternatively, if it was a rental project, it would add about $300 a month onto the rent of that project. And also, it would probably knock out a lot of the small contractors who do this. You don't want to have contracting firms aren't going to have workers who they pay one level at one job, and then where the majority of jobs have to pay another level, they destroy their cost base and their worker base if they were to do that. Fourth point I want to talk about is the 421 tax incentives. We think that there's some serious errors made in this legislation. From the years 2003 to last year, we financed the construction of about 5,000 new units of housing, mainly in the outer boroughs. Most of these buildings were small buildings, under 30 units. About 3,700 units of these units had no subsidy other than the 421 subsidy, and they were affordable to households earning between $90,000 and $130,000 a year, or the middle-income families in the city. With the new law, if you are within what's now the exclusion zone, those same properties, for them to be viable, would have to provide 20% of those housing, or in our 30-unit case, 6 units, to be affordable at 60% of the median income, which means that they couldn't pay for any of the cost of building, and it could just barely pay the cost of maintaining the building. This would put an economic stress on these properties to a point where, given the fragile economics of these areas in any event, that not only wouldn't you build the low-income housing, you wouldn't build the middle-income housing. And in fact, we're seeing that confirmed by what is becoming a dramatic drop-off in any request for this kind of financing. And also, I would question, how in the world are you going to create a regulatory apparatus to monitor 6 units in 30-unit buildings scattered throughout these new inclusionary zones? One of the ironies of this is I think that we financed some of the first privately built rental housing in the South Bronx in probably over 40 years. The South Bronx is now in the inclusionary area. It cannot get 421 as-of-right benefits without providing this additional low-income housing. It doesn't make sense. Hopefully the legislature said they may change that. I hope they do. Let me just, two additional points. When we talk about, I'll wrap it up, I'm probably beyond my 8 minutes, I didn't time this. When we talk about affordable housing, let us not forget what is the major source of affordable housing in the city. That is the existing private housing stock. It's two-thirds of privately owned housing, two-thirds of low-income housing is privately owned rental housing. We have to pay close attention. It should be part of the permanent agenda of the city to make sure that this housing remains economically viable. It's not taxed regressively. Look at the new water and sewer issues. And it does not have regulatory issues that are going to create unfunded mandates, such as some of the lead paint requirements, that are simply unrealistic. And lastly, on a opportunity side, I think with a downturn in the economy, there are great opportunities for creating new affordable housing. The discounting mechanism, the market's going to discount a lot of properties. There's a lot of properties that were oversold, overfinanced. It's possible to buy these, a publicly minded investor, which there are a number around, can buy these, pass on some of that discount to the end user, and thereby create some additional affordable housing. Thank you.
Wow, the bright side. We always like to hear that. Thank you, Mike. So we've heard from an architect and a developer, so of course we now have to hear from a lawyer. Barry LePatner is the founder of the New York City-based law firm LePatner & Associates, which has long been a respected advisor on business and legal issues in real estate, design, and construction industries. He was already a nationally recognized speaker, and then in October he published Broken Buildings, Busted Budgets, How to Fix America's Trillion-Dollar Construction Industry, so I'm guessing that he's even more nationally known now. So we're very fortunate to have him here to talk not just about New York City, but the construction industry as a whole, here and beyond. Barry, I guess, gets along well with architects because they made him an honorary member of the American Institute of Architects, which is a pretty unusual thing. The highest honor the organization can bestow on someone who is not an architect. He's on numerous advisory committees and a member of the City Bar and American Bar Association. Barry.
Thank you, Hope. Rosemary Scanlon's report that is being issued today provides us with a detailed roadmap of the various causes for New York City's high construction cost, as well as why our city is fast becoming a place where soon only the well-to-do will be able to afford to live here. Our city, much like our nation, is on the path to an increased population that in turn is going to require us to build anew, as well as to rebuild our schools, our hospitals, our roads, our bridges, and our tunnels, most of which have exceeded their original intended lifespans. In truth, we are in the midst of a $25 trillion construction boom in our nation between now and the year 2030 that's going to see our nation increase its population by over 70 million people. So the issue of how we deal with our nation's construction, how we deal with our city's construction industry, is crucial to us having a city which is viable and dynamic in the years to come. And we build in this great city with a construction industry that has long proved its value. We cannot attribute the greatness of our city any more to any one group than we can to the construction industry, who solves major problems in helping us have the environment we have today. But the harsh reality pointed out in Rosemary's report is that the need for construction and the continued need for construction has outgrown the industry's capacity to make certain that every project is code compliant, built with properly trained workers, and overseen by project executives with enough experience to ensure a safe workplace for those working on the projects, as well as the city residents who live and walk nearby to these construction projects. By its own admission in the last few years, as you've seen from the charts today, the construction industry acknowledges that it took on more work than it could handle in recent years. And as the last mom-and-pop shop industry in our nation, contractors are truly small businessmen and women who are asked to do an important job in a city where costs for many materials have risen substantially over the past few years. But studies show that nearly 50% of all labor costs on every project are wasted due to the inefficiencies of this industry. And because it is a mom-and-pop shop industry, because there are no General Motors-type companies that build in America today, we are dealing with small businessmen and women with statistics that show that 92% of the 7.6 million construction workers in our nation today work in companies of 19 people or less. That is mom and pop. And that is an industry which is hugely inefficient and explains in large part the reason why those costs are so high, not only in New York City, but around the nation today. And where in our city we expect between now and the year 2010, according to the Building Congress reports, to spend $83 billion on construction. To understand the extent of the inefficiencies we are dealing with is to understand why we are plagued with construction cost overruns and delays on projects that are almost unexplainable to the average builder today. So it's imperative that we begin to take the important steps needed to restore greater efficiency and rationality to the cost of construction if we're going to have our future housing needs met in a way that truly keeps it affordable in the years ahead. Our contracts for these projects need a major overhaul to ensure that owners can secure a true fixed price contract, one where the contractor agrees to accept the risk to build within the parameters of that contract price and assume the risk of those costs if the contractor needs more time or it costs more. We need to have, on the other hand, incentives that should be provided to contractors to ensure that they are rewarded for completing projects on time and on budget. And those incentives can take many forms, and they're not bonuses for incompetence, just the opposite. They are bonuses rewarded for the truly better managed companies who employed the better caliber of workers that we want in our city, doing the job in a safe way that we all need as we grow. And finally, we need to establish a citywide mechanism for tracking the performance of the contractors who do business in this state, and we need to rank them by the quality of the work that they perform. Those that complete the preponderance of their projects in accordance with established budget and schedules should be ranked highest so that other public and private owners will be able to identify them as the best performing companies in their businesses. And those are the ones who should be given future projects, and those are the ones who will have shown that they can prove themselves by performance, not just by merely having a van with their name on it that comes with a little sign for $20 you can buy down the street. I hope that Rosemary's report gets a wide audience and one that it truly deserves, because I believe it is an invaluable yardstick to be used to define the imperatives for ensuring more affordable housing in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. We're now going to move in a moment to the question and answer session. Debbie in the beige jacket there has a mic, so I will call on people, wait for the mic to appear, and when it's put in front of you, if you could give your name and affiliation. I just want to make a couple of kind of wrap-up notes from what I heard today and what I've seen in the report. A big theme is supply. We have plenty of demand in New York, and we need to increase supply across the board. We need to increase the supply of land through zoning. We need to increase the supply of insurers who will be willing to write insurance policies in New York, since every component of the process is a little more expensive here, or a lot more expensive here, and so insurance is one of those components. And we need to increase the supply not just of contractors, but of capable contractors. And this is something that, through the research we uncovered over and over again, and it goes to what Barry was saying about management capacity. It's not just that there aren't enough laborers. There can be enough. There may or may not be, or they can be brought in from elsewhere, but that the firms, the management and supervision and the competence of the firms is what's the limiting factor when we say that there's a lack of contracting capacity and subcontracting capacity, particularly in some specialties here in New York City. The other major theme I heard a lot of is the cost of regulation, that it takes time takes money, that it is potentially a barrier to newcomers, to scare them away, and that in the case specifically of affordable or subsidized housing, that the even additional burdens that are placed on those projects can really be absorbing the subsidies that they're getting or going kind of recycling back into the system in the cost of complying with the regulations. So that being said, does anybody have a question? And if so, if you could just tell name, affiliation, and if you are directing it to a particular speaker. Sir.
My name is Sheldon Lobel. I'm a zoning and land use attorney, also the president of the Zoning Advisory Council. I thank the panel for giving us a wonderful report. I think it may not be a question, but I think that the issue of bureaucracy, coordination, and streamlining of the regulatory system is what we think is the key. Why should a church, and this is one of the ways that we may be able to provide more affordable housing, a church in Brooklyn wanted to add 60 units to a building, much community support, but because the zoning resolution has, which was, this section was adopted 1961, the requirement to get a variance is a stranglehold often. And this Board of Standards and Appeals now is interpreting the law, we think, much too conservatively. And that church wasn't able to provide 60 affordable housing units because it wasn't able to make certain findings. Why should a museum that comes into New York that wants to open up this museum in what is called this M15A and M15B district, some of you may know what that is, adopted 40 years ago, where you can't have retail uses on the ground floor, where zoning requires you to advertise for a year to use it for retail, why should that museum now not be able to open up? Because in an M15A district it may be permitted, but they happen to be in an M15B district. Why should almost every architect know the name of a particular person at the Department of Environmental Protection? Because jobs are held up not by the building department, but by that agency, because one of the people there takes a very, very, very strict attitude. So we think that this regulatory process must be looked at very carefully. Yes, it's good that the mayor and this administration thinks big, as is mentioned in your report, but we think there are many small people in this city, developers, business people, who need to get relief, who, when they file an application now, must hire experts, environmental experts, and pay $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. At one time, to file an application for CEQA, there was no fee. Now it's $50,000, $60,000. So we think the regulatory process must be geared also not to big developments, but to the small people around the city, who the newcomers who want to come here and do business here. That's not a question, but that's our position.
Well, you've hit on a lot of themes, Mr. Lovell, and hand right up, Mark, and then Vicky.
Hi, I'm Mark Alexander, Alexander Development Group. I do have a question, a similar theme, and I would posit the issue about regulation in a slightly different terms. I think in large part society has been overwhelmed by a nanny state mentality focused primarily on protecting us from ourselves. And anti-smoking regulations, bike helmet regulations, seatbelt regulations, all are examples of that. Some of them are perfectly reasonable by most of our standards these days. But I believe that many, many of the regulations associated with housing and development have gone to an extreme level that is becoming extremely expensive and counterproductive. And examples of it are of the excess in this area are the hundreds of thousands of illegal units in single-family homes in Queens that are directly a result of the undersupply of housing in this city, the rooming houses that exist all over lower-income areas of this town, where people in large apartments rent out rooms. In East Harlem, the Mexican population actually rents out beds in apartments. It's not a joke. This is serious stuff. $100 a week to rent a bed in a tenement in East Harlem. That's the going rate for Mexicans. It's an obscene problem, and I believe that the overregulation of this industry encourages it, and I suggest that whereas in most parts of the country there are, and I think in Ms. Scanlon's report she suggests that in this smaller 1-to-3-family construction part of the industry, I think you say it costs about $125 a foot. I actually think you're a little high on that. I think there are builders in this town that actually still build for about $100 to $110 a foot for stick building in the outer boroughs. And that's actually a very affordable price point for the middle-income buyer, and Mike Lappin's folks and the folks at New York Housing Partnership finance a lot of that stuff and sponsor a lot of that stuff. When you go to Black and Plank, though, you jump up about 60% to 70% in your hard cost, and then when you go to Union, you're another 20% or 30% above it, and of course, high rise is even higher. And I would suggest that that jump from the stick to the block and plank is directly a result of fire department and other pressure, union-oriented pressure, to regulate the development industry to create safety standards. We've eliminated scissor stairs. We've required all kinds of special requirements in terms of fire safety and other very, very specific building code regulations that drive up the cost of construction in multifamily housing. And I think it's important for us to look at the political will, and this is where the question is. I think that there's a need to look at the political will to simplify regulations, to streamline, and to rethink some of our obsession almost with safety rules that over time have created an enormous cost burden on the creation of multifamily housing in the city of New York.
Okay, so that sounds like that's for this, Mark.
I want to address that a few ways. I think there's actually some good news on this front. The new building code is a national building code adopted for New York, and I want to talk about the process because I think it's a model for other issues. There are things that will raise costs, particularly on 2- and 3-family attached housing now needs to be sprinklered, and there were some good reasons for that. There will be a number of things that lower costs. Currently now, and most of you probably don't know this, if I need a door, a fire-rated door, it has to be approved for use in New York City by either, currently it's an MEA number, but it also could be a BSA number from older approvals. With the new code, I can use a UL label or other approved national testing laboratories. This is a major change that I think is going, first of all the companies complain that, you know, for each MEA number they're paying $500 a year and a lot of paperwork, et cetera. But it means new products that are approved for use in other parts of the country can be used here much more easily, and I think that's a real positive step. I want to talk for a second, because I give the building department a lot of credit. What they did, and I was involved in this, is they set up 13 committees of a representation of the design construction industry to look at each aspect of the current building code and the proposed model code, and then amended it, and Mark, scissor stairs are still allowed. That was one of the issues that went to arbitration. There were some decisions such as you don't need black iron in residential construction for suspended ceilings, but you still need it in commercial construction, which were probably somewhat political but are a step in the right direction. But what I think is the model of bringing people together and saying, here are the issues, let's talk about them, could be a model for other things such as the zoning resolution, where it seems impossible right now to get a consensus to improve it. So everyone agrees it's broken, it doesn't work well, but then getting a majority of the city council to agree on something and, in effect, public opinion is extremely difficult, and even very small changes become political hot potatoes. And quite honestly, this sort of rationalization and organization is not politically as appealing as rezoning a lot of area and seeing a lot of new attractive high-rise or mid-rise buildings happening. And that needs to happen too. I'm not saying that they're exclusive, but I think there is a model of something that was done right that hopefully could be expanded to other issues. It's not perfect. I expect there will be teething pains, but I think there's some real advantages. And the other thing about this whole new code is it has a three-year update cycle. Our code was last redone in 1968, and the example I always give is atriums were not in the code. So the building department had to try and define what an atrium was without changing the code, because that was a whole process. Now every 3 years, the code can get updated in a rational way, go back to the city council, so that issues like, for example, this issue of these sunshade devices, I've at least raised, so that on the next update of the code, since everyone seems to think the requirement is currently written doesn't make sense, it can be changed so you don't need a revocable consent. And I hope that that is a model moving forward on other fronts, too.
I promised Vicki Beam would be next.
Vicki Beam from the Furman Center at NYU Law School. And this really follows up on Mark's comments. I want to commend Hope and the Manhattan Institute and Rosemary for the report. But I guess I bring to the table a certain amount of frustration because the Furman Center issued a report that highlighted many of these same issues in 1999. We did an update in 2005. Was very well received. Mayor Bloomberg waived the reports and challenged the City Council to implement our 99 reforms. And some has happened, the building code being the major example, but it's all been very slow and very little and much too little, much too late. And so the question really is, what can we do to build the kind of political constituency that then leads to the processes that Mark was really describing, right? How do we get who's going to take the leadership? Manhattan Institute and the Furman Center are research organizations, not advocacy organizations. You've got NYSAFA and Housing First and REBNY and others who are, you know, taking discrete pieces. But who's really going to take the leadership on the political constituency building? And what thoughts do you all have on the panel about how we can push that forward and what that should look like?
I've always thought that when the city's in crisis, I think that's the time when there's the possibility of bold moves. And I've always, you know, being an occasional reader of history, the city's history, I always thought that we're still in a reaction to Robert Moses when he was in charge of 12 or 13 city agencies. And I think we now realize the reason he was doing that, because that was the only way of effectively coordinating the development process. So maybe the pendulum is going to start swinging the other way. I think that it is possible to build political constituencies around some of these areas. The one example I mentioned on Peter Cooper, if we were to save, say, 3,000 units of Peter Cooper's 11,000 units and keep it affordable, and the only way of doing that was to create 1 million feet of zoning rights across the street on First Avenue, you have a natural constituency right there of those 3,000 apartments. I think that kind of thing, when people see that there are ways, when we sort of translate the great need for affordable housing into effective ways of how that can be, and translate that politically, I think we can do that thing. We are now struggling with the Domino Sugar Plant. And one of the things we're doing there is we've struck a very responsive chord with the local community, as we're going to do 30% of those units are going to be affordable housing, which has created a real constituency to upzone that area and rezone it as residential. So I think there are some individual situations. I think these situations can be generalized in a broader area, as in fact these problems, which are very real, find their way into practical solutions, get translated into sort of practical solutions.
The gentleman over there has been waiting.
Good morning. Stanley Gleaton from West Harlem Group Assistance, and thank you also very much. As you were speaking, I felt like my life passing before me, you know, just sitting here, and I'm sitting here with someone who's more intimately involved, our senior project manager, Donald Folt. But the issue that I would like to bring to the table is about the whole issue of, well, of course, the bureaucracy. I mean, all the things that you mentioned is what we're experiencing. But more importantly, and I live in Harlem, I'm a part of the rezoning of 125th Street. I'm on the community board, so that's a whole other seminar. And we talk about inclusionary zoning. We haven't really touched on it, but the whole issue with us at inclusionary zoning is that there's no more land. So, I mean, you can build high rises or home ownership condos or co-ops on 125th Street, which is part of the zoning. But then again, the inclusionary is to build 10 or 20 blocks away, but there's no place to build low-income housing, which is just an aside. Mike Lappin, good to see you. We've worked together, our agencies. And my issue is the whole issue around affordable housing. Because of all of the costs, and we're, you know, obviously affordable housing may become a thing of the past. And I don't want, and it seems like it's the whole theory that we're buying into the theory that we can't build affordable housing, or can we, because it's so expensive. I sit on the community board, and when the developers come to the board, they're not talking about affordable housing anymore. They're talking about other types of housing, market rate, or either home ownership. Because to build, what is the incentive? And that's what I would like to speak about. Let's go towards the end. What is the incentive of building affordable housing? I mean, I work for an agency where our mission is affordable housing. And there are a couple of agencies in the Central Harlem area who have been doing affordable housing, but we've seen it even fallen off because it's so expensive now. I mean, you could build a house that could be affordable, or you could build a condo or a co-op. And so what is the incentive, I'm just saying, that the city is taking, or developers, or the industry at large is taking, you know, to build affordable housing? And again, what is affordable?
Okay, so I'm gonna say a word about that while our panelists decide who wants to take that on. In doing this report, we were concerned about how expensive construction is, and that contributor to the lack of affordability in housing across the board. So we weren't specifically talking about affordable housing, which is generally in New York taken to mean housing built with subsidies of some kind. But obviously we dealt with that, and that's part of our discussion. But the concept was originally construction is so expensive that if we could bring down the costs, then housing across the board could be more affordable to people, and maybe fewer people would need subsidies, or less subsidies would be needed to fill that gap.
I don't know, is anybody ready to solve Mr. Gleaton's problem of affordable housing? Mike, that's you, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess that's me, yeah. Well, I think it really has to do with what the incentives that are built into the, part of it, what the incentives that are built into the zoning. How much additional FAR do you get as a bonus to create affordable housing? I think there's been several efforts to do that. Some have not worked because it just wasn't enough incentive. Some have worked well, and I think you just have, I look at the Greenpoint Williamsburg example. What worked was the incentives along the waterfront. What didn't work was some of the incentives off the waterfront. So that may be a good case study of saying, well, why did the exemption work in one location and not in the other location the incentives work? And what were the reasons that why they worked one place and not another, and make a judgment from that?
I'd also add, and I think I mentioned it before we started the Q&A, that there are some additional regulations precisely because affordable subsidized housing receives subsidies from the government, that the government then imposes additional regulations on developing those. So if you have kind of all other factors being equal, there's almost an incentive in the other direction. There's a disincentive. In addition to the profit disincentive, there's an additional disincentive of cost and aggravation and time, because you could build the market rate without those additional burdens that you have by taking on the subsidized, and now markets.
I wanted to address that for one second as an example of the issue and a potential solution. If you do a project with HPD, typically you have to be reviewed by DACE, which is their in-house architectural division. Typically, if it's city land, and now more and more it requires a rezoning, you then have to go to city planning to go through ULURP, and then you go to the building department or while you're in ULURP. I was involved in organizing the New Housing New York design competition, and we tried to push the envelope in a number of ways. And one of the things we did, and it's not worked perfectly, but I think it may be a model, is instead of having the three agencies totally separate reviews sequentially, often disagreeing, is we got the three agencies in the room and did the reviews together, so that you didn't have the issue that DACE made a planning or site design comment that then city planning said, no, you can't do that, which sometimes meant you had to go back to DACE to get them to accept the change, etc. Is you're trying to unify the comments, and although the building department you're not filing, and that will happen later, by having them at the table, major issues should come up earlier. I think it is working to at least some degree, and I think it's the type of model that would then make it a certain incentive to do affordable housing. Yes, there's this more review, but it's coordinated. And the plus side is it may help you with the buildings department later, and if you're doing a rezoning, it may help you with that later. And so I think that's something that, as a model, could be looked at for a number of different things.
Let me just reinforce that idea. I think that the idea of not even doing it project by project, but doing it almost citywide for this class of projects, and getting these projects building ready, so that the builder does not have to submit themselves to what is now a year or 2 year process for getting this. This will create enormous savings. So I think this is a very rich area that should be explored. Generalizing the things that Mark just talked about for certain classes of properties.
Okay, we have time for one or two more in the back. Nick?
Nick Lembo, Monadnock Construction. I have three quick questions for Mr. LePatner. How does the inefficient American construction industry compare in productivity to the rest of the world? The second is, in terms of the mom-and-pop nature of the business, with which I agree, would you suggest that larger publicly held companies might do a better job? And the third is, how can you reconcile, or how can we reconcile, the need for more highly skilled people to the preservation of lower-paid non-union jobs?
First of all, compared to the rest of the world's construction industries, in my book, Broken Buildings, Busted Budgets, I spent a chapter showing that however inefficient the United States construction industry is, and it's truly inefficient, it is slightly better than those of Japan, Sweden, Holland, United Kingdom, et cetera, et cetera. So we have internationally the same criteria as an industry for construction all across the world. We are slightly better, but by a few percentage points when you do the studies. Secondly, in terms of, I think your second question was about the mom and pop nature of it. We see, when we study construction as an industry, the reason it is the last mom and pop shop industry is that consolidation has occurred for every other industry. The automobile industry 120 years ago was mom and pop shop until Henry Ford came along, put the investment in, and created the assembly line. The iron industry was a mom and pop shop industry until Andrew Carnegie went over to England, brought back the Bessemer steel process, and created today's modern steel industry. Similarly, with the oil industry and every other industry, we have an industry that time has forgotten. It's very unusual. It's a standalone thing. It will begin that process shortly. It may take several decades, but it will begin because the need is there. The business world, the venture capital world, private industry beginning to recognize it, especially when we see the growth, and it's a really noticeable growth now. We haven't seen it until recent years in design build, where projects are being designed and built by one entity to speed up the time process and to bring some level of efficiency. There are some companies around the country who I've spoken with who have become billion-dollar industries by combining design talents and construction talents into one company, and they are becoming very, very good at it and employing technology. The construction industry, everybody should understand, is the lowest user of technology of any industry in the United States. They hardly spend any money on technology. I mean, it's this low. If I showed you the chart that we've, you know, produced in the book, so we need to understand that when you fragment an industry, when it's 80 to 280 different small panel truck companies who pull up and do the big dig, it's not General Motors, and it's the, one of the reasons why there was a big dig problem that took a $2.4 billion budget and ran it up to $14.6 billion and took 10 more years to build. There is a related, different type, but related type of problem, which we can all look at our major civic projects going on in the metropolitan area. All of them, they all have the same threads of problems running through them. We all pay for it. Never, never doubt that when a corporation headquarters doubles in price and you say, well, those folks can afford it, they're rich, never, ever believe that it doesn't translate out into our pocketbooks. When the prices of stadiums double like the Jets and Giants Stadium, never, ever doubt that we're the ones who are going to face $10 Coca-Colas and hats for our kids that are going to cost $30 instead of $19 and parking that's going to be $30 and $35. Never doubt that we are the ones who pay, which is why there is a national economic reason for us to understand the extent of this problem, which costs our economy over $120 billion a year. That's the extent of the inefficiency we're dealing with. We pay tremendously as a hit to our national GDP. And if you want to know what $120 billion of excess monies that shouldn't be there means, it would solve what anybody's version of the Social Security crisis just by taking away some of the inefficiency. So it's a huge problem on that. And I forget your third question.
How do you reconcile the need for more highly qualified people, yeah, to desire to eliminate the need for?
Yeah, here's the issue on that. The issue is that we, those of us in this industry, know that there are many projects around this city that have been built in a questionable way. We're going to see the results of that in the next few years because too many projects were being built by too many newcomers because of the low barriers of entry into the construction industry. You don't need licenses or anything. You need to be able to form a corporation and have a panel truck and some tools, and all of a sudden you're a contractor. What we have to understand here is that we want quality in our construction because it's so important at every level of the economic strata. If you're building affordable housing, low-income housing, or condos that are going to sell for, you know, thousands of dollars a square foot, we still want quality. We have architects who design them properly, who put plans and specifications very carefully together. We need a construction team that builds in accordance with those approved plans. We don't have it all the way. And if it means that certain things don't get done because we don't have skilled workers to do it, I think that's a small price to pay. What happens is when we have markets like we saw projected here, and we know we're going to have $83 billion built between now and 2010, the quality of work should rise because contractors who take on risks, who are held accountable, want to make sure that their workers do the right job so they don't pay the price. Today, because there are very few fixed price contracts, the industry has foisted on all of us contracts which don't hold them accountable, then there's no need to know who's working on your job. And remember this, a construction manager who manages the job is like an orchestra leader. They're not quite sure every day whether the members of the orchestra are going to show up because all of them are independent contractors. They're not controlled, owned, and operated and managed by the construction manager. Construction manager doesn't have that type of control, and we all suffer because of those inefficiencies.
There is our final question.
Marshall Jaffe, Henry Armstrong Associates, and I think Mr. LePadner set me up for this question. Early in his administration, Mayor Bloomberg referred to the city in a discussion about business costs as a luxury product that was appropriate for some types of businesses and not for others. And I wonder to what degree you think that that posture informs the mayor's development policies in general and the attitude about the regulatory issues that influence construction costs in particular.
Well, let's understand this. I mean, I am one believer that the mayor's business attitude has been a huge benefit to this city because we have seen our city grow, and it's prospered during these last few years, and there's now a lot of talk to have somebody like the mayor replace the mayor. So I'm not sure that we've seen too many impediments to having a business-oriented mayor in the city. What we need to understand and what we have to see is where the gaps have fallen in the administration. Certainly, the efforts of the buildings department, as Mark says, from anybody who'd known, has been exemplary. They have made huge strides, and they have truly tried to improve the system. What they never realized was the growth of a construction, the need for new construction in this town was so great that they weren't keeping pace with the need for putting on the right amount of people in the buildings department to have the oversight to understand that construction was going on at a pace that they couldn't inspect properly, and that they had fragmented the inspection process, the safety oversight process, to too many people who didn't see the whole picture. Now, this committee's going on right now. Hopefully, they're going to understand where the gaps were. Hopefully, they understand that they have to consolidate that into one group that is responsible for safety on a project and not disperse that authority. But I think we're on the right track. I think we have a better sense because of these problems we've had in the last year. And all we can do is hope as citizens that they figure it out and put it into a way concomitant with other industry where safety is number one, two, and three. When you go to manufacturing plants around the country in other industries, safety is such a huge issue. It's never a question because they spend inordinately to ensure the safety because stopping work has a huge cost. When we have a safety problem and we stop work on a project, there are huge costs to our city. We all end up paying for it. I'd rather see all of us pay for it up front, meaning have development costs include the requirements for a safety team who watches everybody with the same eyes, overseeing it, not only from the safety of the workers, but also the citizens who walk by in droves.
Rosemary, did you?
No,
okay.
No, that's fine.
I want to thank our panelists and Rosemary. And urge you to, if you haven't grabbed a copy of the report, to take it with you, to tell your friends about it, because I think what Vicky brought up in terms of how to get to the next step, we hope that this event kicks off that kind of discussion that can bring issues to the attention of the administration, that thing, particularly things that are within their power to change, which has been the focus of Rosemary's recommendations. And I wish you a good morning.